If it's happening in the Coachella Valley, it's front and center now.
I love your show. I just love it.
He calls it as he sees it.
So my daughter turned me on to you, and you're awesome.
Live from the Palm Springs iHub.
You know, as a businessman, I spend my entire day, I work hard for the, you know, make money for my family. So I don't have the time to invest and to know what's going on, you know. And that's why I listen to your show, because you tell it exactly the way it is.
This is the Russ Betts Show on iHub Radio.
Welcome to the Russ Betts Show. Good to have you with us. Happy Sunday morning. We're here with you for the next 2 hours, coming to you from beautiful downtown Palm Springs. And it's a little busier Palm Springs. I remember during when we're in the heart of this pandemic closed down, it looked like a ghost town around here. Well, life's come back to the city. And you can see that in some of the national unemployment numbers and some of the other stuff going on. We'll get into that later in the show. But we're going to start out a little different. We got somebody here special in the studio. For those of you who are new listeners to this program, this is my weekend gig to keep you all informed. And during the week, I'm a city council member in the city of Desert Hot Springs. And that takes me to various boards and commissions where I meet some people. And sometimes you meet some people who are really interesting, and sometimes you meet some people who, well, they don't have much to say, and they aren't the most interesting people in the world. They're just government bureaucrats. Well, in this case, and in the studio, is someone who I met in my service at the Airport Land Use Commission, and his name is Stephen Stewart. Stephen, welcome to the Russell Betts Show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here, Russell.
Good. Now, a microphone isn't something you're new to, but and there's a whole bunch of other stuff I find out. As I got to meet you and, you know, serving together up there and talking, I find out, wow, you got a lot going on in your life, don't you?
Somewhat, yes.
So, you know, we're sitting here before the show and trying to go through this list of things, as I normally do with a guest, to try and give them some kind of intro. And rather than going through all this, I'm just going to let this unfold for our listeners. You start to show me an animated movie script that you wrote.
Yes.
Which was a cartoon.
It's a cartoon animated feature that stars CP and DW.
It's called CP and DW. Huh?
BW.
Oh, BW.
Black and white.
Oh, okay. So we're looking at that. Tell me about that. When did that happen?
I started it when I was in the film business as a movie actor and a member of the screenwriters, a member of the SAG.
SAG?
Screen Actors Guild of America.
Okay, good.
I'm a regular screen actor.
We have to let our listeners know all these acronyms.
Okay, and I started writing in the movie business and doing lines at a time, but then I came up with this idea of a cartoon where the character is Dr. Wicked Ray, and he decides to steal the sunlight. And my detective, which is a California Highway Patrol, hence the name CP, rides a horse, a black and white horse that's set up like a motorcycle, and he controls the desert. So he has to solve the problem of the missing ray, so that Dr. Wicked Ray breaks the sunlight down into different colors and makes bricks of them. Now, in the process, I had trucks and came up with the anamorphic car, the talking car. That was 18 years before Disney came out with the talking cars. I have 17 copyrights on those cars. But Disney went around the copyrights, something went wrong, and they didn't use my thing. They invented their own cars, but I came up with the idea back in the 70s. And I produced this script in this movie that I wanted to do, and I'm now turning it into a children's book.
All right, I'm going to divert here for a minute. I had a talking car in the 80s by Chrysler. Did they divert?
That's a little different. That was real time.
A door is a jar. Windshield washer fluid is low. Okay, so you went and created this, was a cartoon screenplay?
Yes, it is. It's an animated. It's a full animated feature.
Now, I watched a lot of cartoons back in the 70s. Did I see this one?
No, I took it to Hanna-Barbera, and they didn't like it because they do limited animation, and they said this was something that Disney would do because it's a full animated like Disney did at one time. And I took it to them, and they thought, well, it's not really something we want to get involved in. And whoever heard of talking cars?
So, well, they went big. Herbie the Love Bug, and was this before Herbie the Love Bug?
Yeah.
And I don't know all the Disney talking cars.
That was at the time. This early 70s. I just finished a picture for Disney, and it was called Carlo the Sierra Coyote, and it appeared on The Wonderful World of Disney, and I think 77 million people watched it.
Wow.
And I filmed that up in Mount Whitney area outside of Bishop, and I played a mountain man whose life was saved by a coyote.
Is that on YouTube now?
It's on Disney. It's not on YouTube yet, but the other one is on Amazon Prime, and that's called The Young Graduates, because we did the sequel to The Graduate that starred Dustin Hoffman, and I played the lead actor in the high school version.
Okay, you're going to have to give me these links because I want to post these on the radio show so everybody can go watch. I want to go watch these.
It's one of those things that one of my first movies. I played a lot of detectives. I played policemen on Police Story. I did 18 films, and in that process, I was writing and trying to break into the writing business. And so then in the 1970s, in 75, I created a story that invented a new way to eliminate bad politicians. And I set it on the shelf because the sequence appeared in two films, and that got me discouraged a little bit that the secret had somebody else had thought about it. And that's when I came up with this axiom that you can use, and this is a quote from me, that if you're thinking of something, three other people are thinking of the same thing and one of them's doing it. So in other words, don't dilly-dally with your ideas because somebody else is already thinking about it. So I put it on the shelf and I broke it out again when last year, a year and a half ago, a friend of mine who's a pilot said, Stephen, you have a very vivid imagination. Why don't you write one page and bring it to me and let me look at it? Because he's an ex-cop. And he's a lawyer, and he says, you have a very good idea. Write something down. So I wrote this one page, brought it back to him, and I said, what do you think? He said, a couple of corrections, and now take it home and go finish the book. That was April in 2021. The book is sitting in front of me here, the manuscript. And I went home and wrote 96,000 words for this book, which happens to be at the publisher right now back in Philadelphia.
Well, you're jumping way ahead of me right now.
I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
You got me going.
Oh, that's right. You want to get to the book. We'll get to that in a second. But I want to ask you, you said you were acting, wanting to get into screenwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And I understood it always went the other way around. You know, Steve Martin was a screenwriter before he became an actor, and he was a screenwriter just to because he wanted to be an actor. Did you have it backwards?
I don't know. I didn't see the rule. I was in college, and I graduated from Cal Poly up in San Luis Obispo with a degree in engineering. But at the school, I got into drama, and we did about 9 plays. The school took them to the hospitals. They took them to Atascadero. They took them to the state prison, that sort of stuff. So we had a traveling troupe of actors, and that's how I kind of got into it. Then I went down to Columbia Pictures and took one of the scenes from the play and did a screen test and was accepted at Columbia Studios to study when I graduated from college.
I did a play once. I was younger. And I auditioned really strong for it, and I got the part. And it was such a disaster on stage that the entire audience of parents were laughing hysterically, and it wasn't supposed to be a comedy. And so after that, I decided, no more of this. This was in third grade, but, you know, you talk about early drama.
You speak of the third grade. That's what at Baker School back in my hometown, I was a fishmonger. I had a little push cart and paper mache fish. And so my teacher says, you have to cross the stage and hold this fish up and tell them it's for sale. And I'd push it across the stage. And that was my very first experience. And I was, God, like 8 or 9 on stage. And I kind of got hooked at it. And it's an ongoing thing that's been there all my life. But it's difficult to make money at it, especially to break into Hollywood when nobody knows you. And you're just straight out off the bus, basically. And I got an audition with Haskell Wexler, who is the Academy Award cinematographer, for a commercial. And so I got the commercial, but in order to get the commercial, I had to join the Screen Actors Guild. And that's how I got into the business. I got the job, then I joined the Screen Actors Guild.
Okay, so, all right, so there you are. The first time you're in a studio, and you see cameras, and there must be a set, right?
Yes.
And I think most people don't realize, like, I actually saw a back picture of the Johnny Carson set, and I thought, you know, he's in this big, huge arena. They make it look really big on TV. But when you actually look at it, it's just a platform, a desk, a curtain, a backdrop, mm-hmm. and everything else around it looks surreal, right?
That's very true.
So did you have that experience when you first went and looked at it? You said, wow, I didn't think it looked like this.
Of course, of course.
Yeah.
And there's 9 people looking at you. You can't see them because they're off camera. And so you have to do your job as the talent and ignore the room, the cameras, the light.
You're not supposed to look at the camera, right?
No, yeah. You look sideways or by it or wherever your point of view is relative to the other
characters. I guess after you've done it a while, you get trained not to look at the camera, but everybody's new who looks at the camera.
You really ignore it.
Yeah, okay. So, all right, let's get to the novel. So it's not enough that you wrote this great animated movie script. You're a screenwriter, getting into the business, start through acting, go that way. Now you're working on a novel because somebody asked you to write a single page.
Yes.
Of an idea.
Yes.
And so from that, they said, okay, great, let's write a book. And well, 93,000 words?
Yes. He suggested I go home and write the book. And that was a year and a half ago.
Now, this is a process manual for operating a factory?
No, it's a murder novel.
That's
it's
the
a
book
murder
I wrote.
Mystery.
That's I wrote a process manual for operating. Okay. That's my only book.
A time and motion study? Okay.
Yeah, it's just showing somebody how to do the whole process from, yeah, that's it, exactly. All right, so you're doing a murder mystery, right?
Yes.
And so tell me about it.
Well, it entails the Detective Scott Blade, who is, and I'll read it when I read you the prologue, you'll see that it all started with a phone call from one of the main characters who knew Scott in college. He doesn't remember her, but she set it up so that when she did something, that she would call a policeman for help.
Okay.
And that's what starts it off, because her and her husband invented a computer program, and Paul, the character's name, he invented an algorithm that goes into a computer program that is a convoluted algorithm that steals pennies off of the dollar. And in the cannabis trade, it's about a $2 billion industry. So he's figured out how to siphon money off for the State Department, because he works for the State Department. And the money goes to the CIA and funds covert activities on Venezuela and South America and things of that nature. But then one of the culprits in the State Department notifies one of his Russian counterparts that get the Russians involved in it because they want that extra money. And that's how people start getting killed to get that money. And that's how Detective Blade and Detective Steele solve the mystery.
Before we get into your reading, because I got to watch the clock here. We're going to come up against a break, and I don't want to interrupt your read. We'll get to that right after the break, because I want to ask you to read part of this. It sounds really interesting. You got a great voice, and obviously you've been an actor, so this is going to be a good, enjoyable read. Let me ask you a couple of questions here. So you go through the plot dynamics, which is, you know, you got to keep the reader interested. But I know in every novel, you always hear these guys say they've researched it really well. Like, you know, if they're doing a book on baseball, drama on baseball, they got to go and actually live with the baseball players. And you start talking about some stuff here that's pretty computer savvy. Do you do the research on that?
Yes, I did.
So what do? You go to some tech firm or somebody and talk to them? Or?
No, I use an iPad.
Oh, okay.
Next to my writing computer. So if I need anything, I plug in the iPad and ask it questions on Russian names and statistics and that sort of stuff.
Well, that's what makes it believable, right?
Oh, it's believable. All my names are real, all the guns that are used, the Russian stuff. It's all in the book.
All right. Well, we're going to real treat when we get back here. Stephen Stewart, I don't know how to describe him, author, screenplay writer, actor. We're back with more on The Russ Betts Show and a reading from his book.
Live from Palm Springs.
Hey, everyone, listen to this, please.
10 years ago, you know, this was a thriving, booming economy, but we're not going to that extent. This thing isn't a total crash.
I want to tell you, you got the radio voice, my friend.
This is The Russ Betts Show.
Wow, that's really honorable.
Now, here's Russ Betts on iHub Radio.
All right, well, every once in a while, you get into this studio and it gets to be really, really fun. Like when you got a great, interesting guest on that's done so much, we barely scratched the surface. But I'm here in the studio with Stephen Stewart, who so far is an animated movie script producer or putting out a children's cartoon. CP and BW is the name of the cartoon. And then we find out he's an actor, and he's working on a novel. It's a fiction novel, murder mystery. And Stephen, I think our listeners would love to hear you go through. Are you going to go through the prologue for us?
Yes, if you'd like.
Go ahead. The microphone's yours. You said you're an actor, so you know what to do, right?
Yes, of course.
Okay, well, cameras are on. Lights, action, camera. Let's go.
Third Tuesday of the month, Detective Blade. It was raining slightly, and everyone knows that it doesn't rain in Los Angeles. After last week, things were different. It was 11 p.m. My doctor released me from the hospital this afternoon. I was standing by my sliding glass door, which led out onto the balcony deck, facing west towards Hollywood. Low clouds, light rain obscured the view of the lights of Los Angeles. It was warm inside the house, and God knows, some space and fresh air could lighten my mood. Pulling hard on the glass door handle with my right hand, it slid open with a swish. The cold, wet Santa Monica onflow hit me in the face, and man, did it feel good. I grabbed a lungful and stepped out onto the deck. Touching the outside door handle again, my body steadied itself for a moment against the breeze, waiting for the rain to wash away the pain from the gunshot wound in my left armpit. My girlfriend, Detective Steele, Beverly Hills PD, drove me home from the hospital this afternoon and was staying over to help me with my recovery. She was doing a great job. She helped the Los Angeles Police Department bomb squad remove a package attached to my house phone. The bomb was live, and Captain Lewis posted two patrolmen at my house to make sure that the bad guys don't return. Standing there by my deck, eyes closed with the cold, wet night air on my face, I was thinking about being alive. Death had missed me twice. A passage from Julius Caesar suddenly invaded my thoughts. Seeing death, a necessary end, will come when it will come. My thoughts began to drift back to that Monday morning when the desk sergeant referred her call to my desk. That was 15 days ago on the first Monday of this month. At my desk, finishing out my retirement with only 11 months to go, that little light on the phone blinked as I folded up a file and slipped it into my bottom drawer of my desk, the later file drawer. I could have been at the coffee pot, in the restroom, or just talking to my partner. No such luck. That damn call light just kept blinking. In the ebb and flow of time and events that pulled you into the event horizon from which there may be no way out, my horizon was that damn phone. I crossed it when I answered the phone. That's my job. I'm a cop. The call was almost a lifetime ago, and now my life's a mess. I could have given anything not to have heard her voice on that phone that morning. Her voice was low and sultry. Some people might call it a whiskey voice, like the ones you used to hear on the old Alan Ladd radio drama, Johnny Dollar, Private Detective. Her speech was tense, on edge, and slightly desperate. It was 9 a.m. on the first Monday of the month, and I was working day watch out of the Venice Division of West Pico. I grabbed the receiver, pushed the button, and said, "Detective Blade, how can I help you?" Her words shocked me, and my eyes riveted on the phone as if it were lying to me. "I'm sorry, ma'am, could you repeat that?" I said. "I shot him," she said anxiously. "Shot who?" I asked for concern. She said, "The man in the black coat." End of scene.
Wow, interesting. Okay, well, I guess, so we're going to get to read that sometime? I mean,
we'll
listen to you read it here. Do I get to go read that for myself somewhere?
You can, yes, and you can also hear it. We're developing a blog, not a blog, but a podcast with Podbeam. It's known audiomysterydramas.com here, emanating from somewhere in Southern California beneath the shadow of San Jacinto and north of the Mexican border from Studio 57 in the high desert of the Coachella Valley.
Okay. All right. Nice little intro there. So now this is a book that you're submitting and hope that somebody's going to publish?
Yes, it's already with the publisher.
Oh, this is with the
publisher? Yes, it was sent out special delivery. They signed for it a Monday a week ago, and they're in Philadelphia.
Are you in the waiting process to see if they accept it, or have they accepted it?
No, I'm waiting.
Okay,
hopefully.
So this is a you know, hey, sitting around, you're going around your daily business, and every once in a while a thought pops in your head, gosh, I wonder if I'm going to hear back from them today, right?
Yeah, they said that it'll take about 10 days. They will send it back to me if they don't want it, but they will talk to me, and I have not heard from them. So in this case, I think no news is good news.
Yeah. All right. Well, can you stick around for after the break? There's so much more. We've barely gotten through all this.
But... Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good. All right. Hey, we're here with Stephen Stewart, who, we just keep rolling off the interesting details in this man's life. And really, I tell you, it's so fun to have somebody in an interview here, somebody like you in an interview for this. It lightens up the station here. Just wonderful. I get all this other political news all the time, and this is interesting. Okay. This is Russ Betts at iHub Radio, coming to you from beautiful downtown Palm Springs. We got other news coming up later in the program. We're going to cover a few things with the unemployment, airline industry, what's going on locally, all that and more here on the Russ Betts Show on iHub Radio.
Read about it tomorrow. See you tonight. Hear it all day today. If it's happening in the Coachella Valley, it's front and center now on iHub Radio.
No way. That's incredible.
Now, here's Russ Betts.
All right, we're back. Russ Betts Show here on iHub Radio. Coming up at the top of the hour, we have... we're going to be talking about the Salton Sea with a special guest, Chuck Parker, who is probably as knowledgeable on this subject as anyone you'll ever want to meet. And we're going to look at what's going on and what's not going on with saving the Salton Sea, which in itself is a misnomer because it's probably already lost. And then we're going to get into some of the, what's going on. I mean, there's something surprising with air travel. You thought the airline industry was dead. And it turns out that, the airline industry is starting to soar back to life. Now, it's not what it was, but I think it's taken everybody by surprise what's going on, and we'll cover that. But we're here with my guest, Stephen Stewart. And I guess since I was talking about airlines, it's a nice little segue, because, Stephen, you and I met where we both serve on the Riverside County Airport Land Use Commission. And, that's where I started to find out about how interesting your life had been. Mm-hmm. Through these meetings that are really rather technical, but of course you get these nice side conversations going on. And so we both serve there. I serve representing cities.
And I serve representing airports.
Airports, okay. And there's other people who serve representing airports, I guess, right?
Yeah, there's two or three, and there's two or three for cities, two or three for airports. So it's kind of balanced.
Yeah, and I think there's an at-large. So I bring the... me and another council, another member, Steve Manos, bring the legislative expertise and everybody else who's a pilot. And so now, in addition to you being writing, a script writer for cartoons and working on a novel and an actor, everything else, you're also a commissioner at the Airport Land Use Commission and a pilot, right?
That's correct.
And so flying's a big part of your life?
It has been.
You have a plane now?
Yes, I own it, and it's over at Palm Springs International Airport in my hangar.
So it's just a private plane that
it's
you just...
It's just a private one.
And that's all you've done is just private flights, just yourself? And so that's the extent of your airline?
Yeah, that's the extent of the private life. I was in the Navy. I was in Naval Aviation, and I served aboard the USS Yorktown, CVS 10, and the USS Philippine Sea, CVS 47. And I did four tours right at the start of the Vietnam War. Aboard the Yorktown, and my job was, I was a teenage airplane mechanic and a hydraulic technician, and my job was to help keep them flying. And then I became a pilot once I graduated from college with a degree in engineering from Cal Poly, because Cal Poly had its own airport in those days, and they taught aeronautical engineering. So I was always wanting to fly because my father put me in a plane when I was 5, and I took my first ride at 8 in a round nose Cessna 195 Alpha with a big radial. And when I was in the Navy, I was on the flight deck for 2 years, and being around all those radial engines for the bombers, we were hunting Russian submarines in those days. It kind of gets in your blood. It's like having a Harley. once you get used to that sound, you just need the input from the exhaust pipe of an airplane engine.
All right, and I understand you did some work with the city of Palm Springs. I learned through conversation with you, Palm Springs has their own airplane.
Yes, they do, and it's a big, nice 182. It sits in the hangar over by the fire department on the other side of the signature side. And I flew, I was executive officer for the Palm Springs Aero Squadron under Chief Jeantron, and I served about almost five years. And I was executive officer of the Aero Squadron and logged 100 hours in surveillance in 47 Papa Sierra.
Now, before we get into all that, I think I mentioned before, I'm a city council member of the city of Desert Hot Springs. We don't have an airplane. How come Palm Springs has an airplane? We need an airplane.
Well, it came about from the old days when all the pilots bought a plane, would fix it and sell it, and came up with the money. When I left the squadron, we had $25,000 in our treasury that was specifically dedicated for the airplane.
So how did Palm Springs get an airplane? Were you there when they decided to buy an airplane?
Yes. No, I wasn't there. That was started long before, but in those days, it was a different aero squadron, and with different people. They're military pilots, and it was just a great group, and I got to fly with them. I got to fly with the sheriff's association up and down the coast in what we used to call the sheriff's shootout, and it was just a great group of guys until politics got into it, and we changed chiefs. And suddenly that money started disappearing, et cetera, et cetera. And now I may see 47 Papa Sierra one time a year in the air. It's no longer the aero squadron that I was a part of.
Okay, well, they got an airport, so I guess it stands to reason they got an airplane. We don't have an airport in Desert Hot Springs. So, all right, so what? Any interesting stories? What'd you do on, what did the Palm Springs do with this airplane, or what were you doing piloting it?
We would go on patrol, do traffic. There was a co-pilot and a flight officer in back. We had very special radios. We could talk to every police department in the Coachella Valley. We'd just circle the city and look for anything, traffic accidents, call it in. Sometimes I would fly the CSI guy in the back with the cameras because we have a fishbowl side of the airplane. It's a highly modified airplane for surveillance. And we would look for a set of bike thieves. In the old days, when they had the motorcycle runs here into Palm Springs, they had a lawn truck that was all decked out with a trailer. Well, the trailer would be backed up over a very motorcycle. Inside the trailer, it would pick up the motorcycle, close the back doors, and drive away and steal the motorcycle. And I was part of the air group that was looking for it, and we found it up at one of the fast burger places, and we tracked it back and were able to catch the thieves who were stealing very, very expensive custom-made Harley-Davidson motorcycles. And when the trailer left and the bike was hanging on straps inside, you couldn't see it. The back doors were closed. It looked like another gardener going down the streets of Palm Springs.
Wow. You were telling me that you were doing some surveillance and you would do like a dive bomb into the house, or what would you do?
Well, yes, I mentioned that to you earlier, that on one sequence just outside in Desert Hot Springs, actually in the edge of Sky Valley, there were some people growing marijuana that in those days it was still illegal. So I had the CSI in the back, and they wanted to do a tag photographs. So I would go up really high and nosedive down and get up to maximum speed, shut the plane off, gear it down as quiet as possible, and just fly by at, say, 100 feet off the ground so that the cameras were rolling and could catch license plates and things of that nature. I'd coast on down, turn it back on, and glide out so no one would hear the engine.
So unless they happened to be looking at the time, they might just only hear a whoosh as you went by, and that was it, huh?
That's correct.
All right.
That's correct.
Interesting. So, so that airplane's not being used much now, huh?
No, not the police one.
Wow.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah, well, I'm going to look into that one. That's something I got to research. Maybe they don't want the plane. We'll take it. There must be some cost associated with keeping
very
that plane.
Very much so. It's, planes are expensive. They cost a lot of money just to sit because of insurance, upkeep, hangar fees, et cetera. It's kind of what I relate to, kind of like having a mistress and a Ferrari. They're both expensive and dangerous. So that's my definition of owning an airplane. It's expensive, fun, and dangerous.
Well, I think the Ferrari's infinitely less dangerous than the mistress.
That's the expensive part.
Yeah, that's a trouble you don't need. And all right, so let's see. You're on the flood control district, which doesn't sound like a wildly exciting subject, but we got a flood control channel out in Desert Hot Springs that we've been trying to get through for 20 years and getting into my city council side and bugging you. This flood control channel, what it does is when they define it, when your flood control district defines here's where the channel is going to go, now it provides development certainty to people who have property along that flood control channel. Okay. But until we got that certainty, nobody really knows where they can or can't build.
I will let you know when I talk to the chief on this subject and find out which one you're talking about, and I'll get you some, since you're on the city council, I can get you some of the maps and things of that nature that I'll call them up and have them sent to me so that you can see a little bit about it. It lists the budget and what's been allocated to, say, your specific problem. See if I can help you out.
Okay, well, 10 years ago, I was the liaison where they had a few meetings in Desert Hot Springs with the map, and everybody's bugging them back then. Maybe it's 12 years ago. Anyhow, all right, good.
One quick point. Remember you mentioned your next guest is going to talk a little bit about the Salton Sea.
Yeah.
Being on the board, the Flood Control District, I wrote a paper as an engineer as to how to bring seawater from San Diego to put it into the Salton Sea. Gravity, using gravity, solar, electric motors, and gravity to flow it down. Kind of a large siphoning effect from the ocean. And I sent it in, and I never, ever heard a word.
For some reason, when it comes to bringing in seawater to the Salton Sea, nobody ever hears a word. And that's what the conversation's going to be at the top of the hour when we get to that. Because we've got every city in this Coachella Valley saying, bring in the seawater mm-hmm. from the Salton Sea. And it's an engineering study that needs to be done. You've done one. First I'm hearing about this. And other people have done them. There, I know two engineering firms who I've talked to. They said it's all very doable. It's all very possible. Well, certainly Sonny Bono was pushing the idea. Mm-hmm. What's behind everybody that doesn't want to do that? You know what they're talking about doing now? They're talking about covering 30,000 acres? Mm. Is it 30,000 acres?
Probably. It's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
With gravel.
Yeah.
And they did that up at Zoens Lake, and it works. I'm you know, people who are listening now are going to hear what Chuck Parker and I talk about later. But so anyhow, all right. Well, the flood control channel, and then
you know, it's so easy, Russell, to pump water up halfway in the pipe, get it over the hump, and then the siphoning effect, along with solar-powered motors and some from the grid, will allow the water to rush down from a certain mountain all the way to the Salton Sea through a conduit, just as Mulholland and the Wrigley family built the aqueduct and brought the water to Los Angeles, or Los Angeles would be a desert today had they not had the forethought to bring water here. You can do that, and it's so simple to save the Salton Sea. It's just...
We've got aquifers that run all over the place. It's not like, you know, it's not rocket science.
Now, I got one thing for you. Do you know where the little fish came from and all the little sea urchins in the Salton Sea came from? They came from World War II, because when San Diego was fogged in, the PBYs and the PBMs would land in the Salton Sea and flush their bilges. So whatever they had collected in the ocean wound up over here.
Oh.
And that's how you have marine life in the Salton Sea, which actually came here during World War II when they were using the Salton Sea as a nuclear test site for dropping five nuclear weapons that were used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That Salton Sea had all the cameras set up, and that's where they did the test drop to prove the altimeter worked and went off 1,500 feet above the water level. It's all in the history
books.
Not
a live bomb, right?
No. It was a real bomb, weighed the exact same, but it had a milk bomb in it that blew up like a gunpowder bomb. But it had to show that the altimeter fuse worked, because the bomb being so complicated, it couldn't hit the ground or it would break and it wouldn't go off. And all that's in the Palm Springs Air Museum.
Wow.
You're
involved in the Palm Springs Air Museum, aren't you?
Yes, I'm a technical advisor, and my company makes a few parts for them.
That would be a whole other radio show
to get you
in here, huh?
I made the bolts to hold some of the wings on, because they can't get them. The Air Force don't make them anymore, so they gave me a couple and said, can you duplicate this? It only weighs 2.5 pounds.
And you know Fred Bell?
Yes, yes. Very,
yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, good guy, huh?
I like Fred. Yeah, he's a nice
man. He's done a great job down there. Wow, it's really expanded, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, there's an airplane in there that's called the Air Coupe, the little blue one. I'm the only one qualified to fly that airplane. I have 600 hours in that type.
Have you flown it?
I owned one for 6 years. I haven't flown that one, but I own one exactly like it.
Right.
And I did 100 air shows in that same model and type.
Wow. Steve, what's the name of your book?
It's called The Man in the Black Coat.
All right, The Man in the Black Coat. We're waiting to see. You'll let us know where that turns out. I'm sure we'll hear about that one, right?
Absolutely, when you ask me next time.
All right, really appreciate having you in here as a guest. Good show. Good time having you here. All right, this is Russ Betts on iHub Radio saying goodbye to Stephen Stewart and continuing with the show here in just a bit on iHub Radio.
Thank you for educating so many of us. I think you're the best.
We are the people in your neighborhood.
With great power comes great responsibility.
This is The Russ Betts Show.
Well, that was fun. We just got through with an interview with Stephen Stewart. It's really nice to meet some interesting people. And all right, we're going to shift gears and get back onto our normal regular fare, which is what's going on local. I got some news coming up here on the airline industry soaring back to life. That's the headline in The Hill? And then a few other places I've seen that, if you're going to fly to China, you would think, the plane's going to be empty. They've dropped the airfare down to nothing. And no, that's not the case. You can't get a seat on a plane to China. They're so booked. And same with a lot of travel overseas, other places too. It's really astonishing. It's caught everybody by surprise. But I'm going to turn our attention right now to Desert Hot Springs and the local economy and the unemployment rate. And, Desert Hot Springs has landed the highest unemployment rate award. That's where we're at. Our unemployment rate, it shouldn't be that way. It need not be that way. But it is. Desert Hot Springs has had an industrial boom. It's been absolutely fantastic what's taken place with the cannabis industry and the new jobs that have come. And those jobs typically are very, very good jobs, providing a very good living and providing employment. Well, that's not what's happening in Desert Hot Springs, because obviously that industry, by the way, kept going. It didn't suffer huge shutdowns like, the retail, the hotels, everything else, the car rental, everything else that employed people that ended up shutting down and creating this huge unemployment crisis. 25% is the unemployment. Well, no, let me get you the exact number. Desert Hot Springs, 23.5% unemployment rate. It's huge. The number's all over the place, and we've got some good news that number's coming down, but Desert Hot Springs has the distinction of having the highest unemployment in all of California. At the same time, it's had this huge boom in new manufacturing coming into the city. I mean, we've had a surge of manufacturing employment in Desert Hot Springs with the installation of these cannabis manufacturing facilities. And these are manufacturing jobs. These are good jobs. They pay well. They have benefits. And those are the jobs that should be coming to Desert Hot Springs residents. That was the promise. And for sure, the city has made out well. All that cannabis manufacturing and the associated taxes that go with it is keeping the city afloat. Because while Desert Hot Springs has the highest unemployment in California, it's also not suffering some of the financial budget difficulties that other cities are seeing. Well, it's because 27% of the city's revenue comes from cannabis, either manufacturing or dispensary sales. So we should not be at, an unemployment rate with 27% of our revenue coming from an industry located in our city, 27% of our local economy, and yet 25% unemployment rate. The two, something's wrong. Something is very wrong here. Now, I've installed lots of manufacturing facilities in my career, well, five to be exact, and never once did I pay a tax to a local government. You don't pay a tax to local government on manufacturing and the right to manufacture. There's VATs, but those come in nationally. Every time I brought jobs, every time the city I brought those jobs to said, thanks, they loved it. And never once did they say, by the way, now you're going to pay a square foot manufacturing tax on top of it. But they did say something else. They said, by the way, those will be local jobs, right? You're bringing jobs. We love it. But you must hire from our town or the surrounding unincorporated parts of our town. And the focus was jobs and the economic benefit that those jobs bring. That was the focus, the economic benefit that those jobs bring. So how does that come about is the next question. I mean, how do you get a manufacturer locating in your city to actually provide some good for the people that live in your city and not just tax us to City Hall? Well, in our case, we were manufacturing back in the 80s, Jimmy Carter era. Interest rates were sky high. If you were lucky to get a loan at 14 or 18%, you were doing good. So we went back into Western Pennsylvania. We'd looked over all over the other states. We settled in on Western Pennsylvania, and they offered us 2% loan for land and building and a 4% loan for equipment and inventory. We said, okay, we startup company, you know, we've got history behind us sufficient enough to, you know, be taken seriously, but yeah, that's a nice little boost. We could take that help. They said, okay, that low interest money is yours, but it's tied to you hiring this many people. And so, okay, we agreed to that. And things went pretty well. We met our requirements to hire people. We got those loans. We paid them off, and everything went exactly as it was supposed to be. And again, the focus of the elected officials was jobs and the economic benefit that those jobs bring to the residents and the city. We need to do the same in Desert Hot Springs. And 2 years ago, I put forward a program to do that in Desert Hot Springs, and it's so far been ignored. And I would hope with the reality of these numbers, you know, with this contrast, 23.5% unemployment, the highest in California, while at the same time we have an economic boom in that industry, that our city staff and our city council will finally take a serious look at this program I put forward to create more jobs in our city. And it basically, it's the same trade-off that we saw when we went into Western Pennsylvania. For every job you create, you get a benefit. Now, if you haven't noticed lately, interest rates are really low. So you're not going to go offer anybody any low interest money. What's really high is the tax rate on the per square foot tax rate. One of those taxes is in Desert Hot Springs is incredibly at $25 per square foot. Now, that's only on the first 3,000 square foot, but that's a huge number, way out there. And I think there's some talk among my council members for getting rid of that. But what needs to happen is that needs to be, we need to get something for that. You know, don't just give it away. Sit there and say, you know, for every employee you have with a Desert Hot Springs address or the very near surrounding county areas, there'll be a reduction in that tax. Anyhow, we need to do something. Jobs have always got to be the focus for City Hall. And I know they've got expenses and they want to keep their show going, but, you know, it's not like the castle and the serfs all around the city. The castle and the serfs all surrounding it. You know, the peasants. It's got to be about helping those peasants see a better life. That's our job. And anyhow, it just staring me in the face this morning when I looked at these numbers and I saw Desert Hot Springs is at 23.5%, and I'm hearing all this time that, wow, has the cannabis industry been going good? All right, we're back with more here. This is Russ Betts on iHub Radio. Did my pontificating. We're back. Chuck Parker, top of the hour, Salton Sea Authority. Discussion.